Hey everyone, welcome back to the Institute on Science for Global Policy's podcast, The Forum. Right here is where science comes to socialize. And today I'm accompanied by the usual suspects, Aubrey and Daniela.
Hey guys, Daniela here. Don't forget to check out each of our past episodes on SoundCloud. If you want recommendations, we'd be happy to help you figure out which ones suit your interests.
And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at ISGPForum, and you can use the hashtag ISGPForum to interact with us directly. And of course, you can also follow us on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum in the search bar. All right, let's get started with today's episode.
Excellent idea. The paper and debate on the table today come from the conference Sea Level Rise, What's Our Next Move? That took place in St. Petersburg, Florida on October 2nd through 3rd in 2015.
The paper that inspired the debate comes from John Englander, the president of the Rising Seas Group in Boca Raton, Florida. His paper is titled Shoreline Adaptation Land Trust, a Concept for Rising Sea Level.
So today we're going to be talking about climate change, sea level rise, land trust, and the implications of these beasts. Yes, we're packing in some pretty controversial information today, but someone's got to do it.
Someone? Try everyone. This information is pretty pressing, a factor which should be encouraging more scientists to reach out and educate the public on these topics, especially those in low-lying coastal areas.
That's a great point, Daniela, but we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves here. We'll return to this idea of education later, but let's first break down the realities of sea level rise discussed by the debaters at this conference.
All right, so first things first. The reality of sea level rise is no longer a question, but a very real occurrence that is already affecting some areas of the world. Unfortunately, the actual rate of rise can't be predicted because we don't have a way to measure the collapse rate of the Antarctic glaciers.
And because of this, scientists are unable to fully predict if sea levels will rise a few feet or all the way up to something like 13 feet by the end of the century. And as Antarctica and Greenland melt, we also face the challenge of sea levels rising unequally from location to location, and perhaps faster than predicted.
It's weird to think that the sea wouldn't just level out, like it does in a pool or even a lake.
This definitely is a strange concept, and not at all intuitive. But sea levels will most likely be higher where the mass of the Earth is denser. Take most regions around the equator, for instance.
So we understand that there are definitely some gaps in information here, but it can be stated with scientific certainty that, number one, land temperature has risen 1.5 degrees Celsius in the past 250 years.
Number two, ice sheets are in fact melting.
Three, Antarctic underwater glaciers are eroding.
Number four, sea levels are rising.
And finally, number five, shorelines are moving. So, aside from the fact that drowning is less than cool, why do we have to be concerned by this reality? Well, although sea level rise, or SLR as we like to call it sometimes.
Yes, God forbid we miss out on an acronym opportunity.
Anyway, although SLR doesn't pose the same immediate and severe threat as a major storm, like Superstorm Sandy, it still intensifies the impact of storms on coastal areas, which includes increasing erosion and extreme high tides around these exact areas.
So basically, you're saying that we're not dealing with a tsunami here, but that sea level rise is more quietly creeping up on us and will intensify the effects of already strong coastal storms.
Exactly. And perhaps the scariest part is that this trend of rising seas can't be quickly reversed because of the amount of heat already stored in the oceans. It's there and not leaving anytime soon, especially not without causing some sticky situations first.
Don't you mean salty situations?
Good point.
Sticky or salty, is there nothing we can do? That can't be right, or else we wouldn't have an episode today.
You're a clever one, Aubrey. The answer is adaptation. The debaters thought planning for adaptive mechanisms would be imperative to ensure coastal community survival, as in, these communities will not survive without some forward thinking.
That's pretty harsh, Daniela.
Hey, it's not me. It's what the experts say.
And I can definitely see why this can be a frustrating situation. We all know about how coastal communities are on the verge of being washed away, yet condominiums and houses are being built all along the U.S. shoreline, both in the north and the south, seemingly without considering this possibility of imminent destruction.
Okay, well, people building along the shoreline, at least in the U.S., are more than likely very wealthy. So wouldn't they have access to the resources needed to deal with the problem? Or even possibly have a second inland home where they could resort to?
Well, sadly, it's not just the immediate high-value waterfront properties that are a threat here. In fact, affected areas could easily include less affluent and inland communities as water is directed inland during flooding events.
I see. Seems like a sticky, salty situation we've gotten ourselves into. Let's start talking solutions so we can turn this conversation around, shall we?
Definitely. So, as Daniela was saying, we need to adapt, and quickly at that. SLR itself occurs at a relatively slow pace, but the ongoing threat of those storms we were talking about calls for urgent adaptation. Focusing on mitigation, but more importantly, resiliency, will be a serious key here. The debaters noted that technology would play a significant role.
Right, and scientific opportunities and adaptive technology, engineering strategies, and architectural designs actually already exist. And if applied, these could allow structures to be easily disassembled and then moved when sea levels get too high.
Whoa, that puts a whole new spin on the term mobile home.
That all sounds really cool, but we can't forget that wetlands, mitigation areas, buffer zones, and horizontal levees, all of which help mediate storm surge, also need to be part of the gradual preparation measures taken by high-risk areas over the next 30 to 50 years.
And this fancy resiliency technology also has to be designed at the proper height for sea level rise. Costly large-scale projects, such as those in Venice and the Netherlands that plan for only 1 foot of rise, are clearly not enough to ensure future efficacy.
So, I'm realizing that we're forgetting about one of my favorite topics and a very crucial sector here, food. But, okay, let's talk agriculture for a minute. Sea level rise could very easily affect current food-producing acreage, manufacturing spaces, and even transportation.
Good point. And saltwater intrusion is sure to affect the water table. Desalinization could be an option here, but it definitely doesn't come without its financial and structural complications. Opportunities also exist, though, in other adaptive strategies that offset costs, such as creating and using halophytes.
Halophytes?
Yeah, halophytes are plants capable of thriving in brackish environments.
And brackish environments? Cleo, can we speak English here for a minute?
When we say brackish environment, we mean one that contains more salt than freshwater, but less salt than seawater.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, well, I've definitely learned something today.
Well, pretty soon we're just going to have to face the fact that as the land area shrinks and human population continues to increase, viable agricultural land will simply be lost.
And it doesn't really help that the development of adaptive technologies is hindered by government policies that are, believe it or not, discouraging the discussion of SLR and climate change. Cough, cough, Cleo.
Don't even get me started on Florida and the government's highly controversial decision to ban the Department of Environmental Protection from using the terms climate change and global warming.
Oh boy.
Yep, good old Florida.
Anyway, back to solutions. Before Cleo vows to never return to her home state now that she's migrated to Virginia. So the debaters felt that shoreline resiliency and restoration are equally important, requiring investment in both measures simultaneously on the part of affected communities. So this means investing in immediate protection measures as well as long-term adaptation measures at the same time.
We get it, Daniela. Simultaneous.
A possible way to get started with this is the land trust program called SALT, or Shoreline Adaptation Land Trust. Yes, we are acronym happy today.
SALT facilitates SLR adaptation by incentivizing homeowners to voluntarily donate their property to a trust while still maintaining access to and use of the property for a designated period of time. This time period could range anywhere between the length of the mortgage to the lifespan of the homeowner.
The homeowner would also be entitled to receiving a charitable write-off, just as if the property were being put into a conservation land trust. The homeowner would also be incentivized through exemption from some or even all property taxes.
Though if this strategy were to be widely adopted, these taxes would probably have to be reduced slowly rather than all at once, so that the significant source of revenue that they constitute isn't lost abruptly. With the property taxes reduced or eliminated over time, we'd naturally have time to develop alternative revenue sources to fund public services.
Sounds like a pretty sweet deal. But public acceptance is a big roadblock here. I mean, just signing over your land for the greater good may not come as an easy decision for everyone.
For sure. It was actually emphasized by our debaters that the key to public acceptance of a land trust program is the assurance that there will be broad community benefits from the exchange.
These public benefits could include reduced beach renourishment and infrastructure expenditures, enhanced public use of the donated property while the donor is still living there,
Like beach access.
and once the donor vacates the structure, the ability to oversee demolition so as to avoid severe environmental damage.
Which is significant because extreme damage is what usually takes place when abandoned structures wash into the sea. And the debaters took this idea one step further, actually. It was suggested that a demolition fund be integrated into SALT, one that is funded by a progressive property tax. And this tax would address the environmental liability left behind when homeowners finally leave their houses.
Even with these issues addressed, SALT is not without its contentions. The major one being, besides public acceptance, is the shift from private landowner to the public ownership concept. It turns into a monetary cost, and a pricey one at that, because, well, there needs to be money available to buy the property out at its present-day value.
Plus money to demolish and remove structures on the property and then restore the lands.
And then more money to provide public services to the untaxed homeowner for as long as they live there. That's a lot of money we're talking about.
It's definitely recognized that there's really no way to avoid lost revenue and the restoration costs associated with SLR, but will SALT just worsen the situation?
There were definitely some worries from the debaters that this plan could ultimately benefit the more affluent while the less affluent gets stuck paying for the government services.
But wait, we may have solutions for this too. In order to prevent the less wealthy from bearing the brunt of these costs, properties under a $100,000 value could potentially receive preferential treatment as compared to the more expensive properties.
And in addition, SALT could work better if it's first implemented inland on less expensive properties in low-lying areas that routinely flood. This way, we could avoid the issue of reducing or eliminating property taxes on beachfront properties. You know, we're talking those valued in the millions, which would have a severe impact on the entire community's tax base.
Who is developing and overseeing all of this, though?
Well, a project like this necessitates cooperation from federal, state, and municipal governments to develop, implement, and fund adaptive vehicles like SALT.
One source of help is the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act, which is a decades-old program that encourages the responsible management of coastal areas and provides grants for coastal maintenance.
So, in theory, legislation like this could be adapted to address our current situation in local municipalities.
But even so, SALT programs would majorly shake things up due to their revolutionary nature. And if you're not yet convinced that they are the solution to the sea level rise problem, the debaters did suggest a few alternatives.
Yep, one thought was that governments could refrain from artificially intervening in coastal relocation altogether and just let coastal property values bottom out naturally. In this way, government could direct new investment to appropriate areas that reflect the least risk.
Rebuilding policies could also be restructured such that certain restrictions are imposed below certain elevations, like only allowing the construction of easily removable structures in the 10 to 0 feet above sea level range, or something like that.
Well, whether it's through land trusts or other investments, there's still a great need for mechanisms that aid vulnerable communities in their migrations.
Not to mention the huge component of education that I finally get to bring back up. Regardless of the adaptive strategies employed, we need policies that establish education programs that raise awareness about those very adaptive strategies and about the implications of sea level rise.
A concept which brings with it a lot of challenges. First of all, scientists have a hard time communicating effectively about SLR simply because of all the uncertainties associated with the research. Shout out to episode 15 of the forum, called Lost in Translation, which talks about communicating uncertainties associated with other parts of climate-related science.
This, of course, only exacerbates the problem of having a population that denies sea level rise and climate change in general. And reaching out to these people is quite difficult, as they don't tend to be the ones actively engaging in sea level rise education campaigns.
Exactly. Meetings or education materials for the public tend to just preach to the choir, so to speak. All hope isn't lost, though. I mean, it's definitely possible to find ways to communicate about SLR realities while also minimizing controversy.
I mean, I haven't personally found any, but go on.
Well, we can start with the agreed-upon fact that, regardless of your political party, ice does melt at 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, this is definitely a good, uncontroversial start. And from there, policymakers need to be encouraged to communicate four key points that will hopefully increase public engagement on the issue.
And the first point is that the Earth is demonstrably warmer.
Point two is that warmer temperatures cause ice to melt. Remember that 32 degrees thing.
The third point is that melted ice causes sea levels to rise.
And lastly, rising waters cause the shoreline to move inland.
Seems pretty simple to me, actually, but it's ultimately up to the citizens, municipalities, cities, and countries to move forward.
So, let's turn it over to our listeners. How big of a role do you think education plays in the acknowledgement and proverbial fight against sea level rise?
Are plans like SALT really the way to go? Or perhaps SALT is too drastic? Are there better solutions that we didn't talk about today?
Let us know your answers to these questions and ask us your own by tweeting at ISGPForum with the hashtag ISGPForum. That's all we have for today, but you know this subject isn't going to be laid to rest anytime soon. Until then, everyone, we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.